Before we delve into what is one of the longest and most complex culinary traditions on Earth, China, let's do some theorizing which might explain how and why this is the case. First, why do some cultures have strong, complex culinary traditions and others don't? And there are two underlying factors that help, but I think are not absolutely essential. Well, first is a variety of ingredients, either grown or imported and marketed, and those that can be obtained by a good proportion of the population. Now, this helps. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. You can have a very sophisticated cuisine based on very few ingredients. I mean, think of classical Greece or Japan as maybe the best example. Number two, I think you need time. You know, long, stable kingdoms or relative peace and prosperity over a long period during which culinary techniques can develop and become perfected. And again, I don't think this is absolutely necessary, but you could argue that brilliant cuisines can in fact pop up in a short space of time and then disappear. Medieval European cooking might be a very good example of that. And in fact, it had very little impact on European cooking in later centuries. But let's think then, what's essential? What do you need to absolutely to have? You need one of the following three conditions for any culinary art to develop, I believe. You need a strong tradition of the family and household as the basic unit of production. And ideally, an extended household in which members of many generations live together, and what would they do? They pass down cooking techniques from generation to generation. And this could be from grandmother or mother to daughter. And you know, think about it. And here in the US, we really don't have that anymore, right? Or it's seriously decayed, maybe surviving among some ethnic groups. But how many of you today cook or eat like your grandparents did? In China, the family, filial piety, obedience to parents, respect for elderly, and even ancestor worship means that food customs and cooking techniques get passed down for centuries. And there's respect for old ways, which means that they change very little over time. They could be perfected, but they're still essentially the same. Another possibility is a vibrant court culture involving a concentration of wealth, usually an autocratic rule by an emperor or a king, some patronage networks, and a degree of social mobility, or at least access to that court through serving in the state bureaucracy, maybe as a palace priest or serving in the army. Meaning other wealthy people would imitate the court and its customs tend to circulate, right? And if you think of a totally closed court that would only involve a handful of people, that would depend more on the whim of each ruler than long-established customs. I mean, maybe Ahsoka's vegetarian Buddhist empire is a good example of that. In any case, in China, an extensive court culture and access to it as a state employee, a priest, a soldier, that spreads the imperial cuisine, even if it could never be as elaborate or as grand outside the court. Now, in lieu of these two other things, I think the other possibility is a thriving restaurant culture, with many people who can eat out often, sort of competition among professionals to attract customers. And that's really the key to 19th century France. And I think you could say to the United States today, there isn't a really strong extended family anymore. There never was a real court per se. So with China, arguably number one and two, there's a wealth of ingredients, native and imported, with an extraordinary series of stable dynasties. That has the potential to be the most varied, complex, and sophisticated cuisine on earth. And many people would argue just that. You know, few other traditions even come close. I mean, you think classical French haute cuisine, that's less than 250 years old. Italian food, even younger if we think how long it took, you know, to match up things like tomato and pasta. But let's start with the earliest Chinese civilization we know a lot about. That's the Xia period. This is after the advent of agriculture, domestication of animals, pottery, all of which happens just slightly after it does in the Fertile Crescent. Pigs, for example, are domesticated about 8,000 BC. Dogs even before that. You have rice, millet. Those are cultivated by 7,500 BC. And, you know, by the civilizations that coalesce around the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers, these are intensely fertile areas with lots of water. This time also, there's the oldest Chinese pottery, although a pottery apparently began even before agriculture. And some recent work suggests that pottery was in use by cave dwellers in the Hunan region of the Yangtze River from over 15,000 years ago. Only Japan comes close. That's the Jomon ware. But typically you find pottery jars filled with things like seeds, you know, often something like cabbage seeds would be kept over the winter to be planted the next year. Water buffalo also, probably domesticated in China by about 4000 BC. And then we have chickens, which probably came from the south. And all these were independent discoveries. You know, they're not imported from somewhere else. And in any case, the same processes happened here. We know they ate bamboo shoots, persimmons, those are both native. They were also the first to cultivate cannabis for rope fiber, for edible seeds, for medicinal, and perhaps even for pleasure-related purposes. And by the Xia period, there were many flourishing city-states. I mean, we're talking advanced civilization with large populations that are contemporaneous with the Indus River Valley, with dynastic Egypt, with Crete and Mycenaean Greece. And then, exactly like elsewhere, about 1500 BC, these civilizations are invaded from the outside by so-called less civilized people. In this case, they are the Shang, who are culturally a lot like the Aryans in that they're pastoralists, they're warlike nomads who fought on chariots and use bronze weapons. You know, interestingly, it doesn't always pay to be the more settled culture with more advanced agriculture. I mean, it kind of makes you prey to outsiders too. But as with other stories we've discussed, the Shang came to stay. They absorbed the earlier culture and eventually developed things like laws, money, a system of markets, much more sophisticated pottery. And they also began to build walls. And these are basically to keep out the other barbarians. And in the Shang dynasty, they developed a system of writing, which is pictographic. And it's actually the ancestor of modern Chinese script. This is also naturally the first historical period. During this time, they started using these huge bronze cooking vessels. They raised silk worms for clothes. They used crack bones for divination and in fact, already practiced a kind of ancestor worship. And maybe most important is that the Shang were ruled by kings and began to hold the kings responsible for the welfare of the people and the fertility of the crops. Rituals, proper sacrifices had to be made to ensure the future crop. So the kings actually take on a kind of religious function. Okay? The Shang grew millets. Wheat eventually makes its way there, some rice, but strangely, it was warmer in this period, but actually drier. So rice could only be grown in the more wet regions. And they also grew grain for making ale. And evidently the Shang were heavy drinkers, or at least the later dynasties characterized them as such. There are huge brewing vessels that survive. And the last Shang ruler was said to have had a lake of beer and a forest of meat. And people are wondering, what could a forest of meat mean? Well, I think it's that they were hanging up strips of meat to dry on the trees. And so it looked like a whole forest of meat. The Shang ruled with a series of loyal vassals, a kind of feudal system to govern their outlying regions. So there is, in fact, an aristocratic class and a loose court that they are connected to. And each vassal ruled over, let's imagine, their own little mini court containing huge extended family of relatives living in a common palace or administrative center, right? Think of Mulan. That's, you know, the structure. The Shang also had some kind of slavery, but there's a lot of disagreement over it. Marxist scholars assumed that they had to have slaves, because that's an inevitable stage in history. But we do know that when rulers died, they were often buried with their retinue of servants. That includes wives and slaves. And incidentally, they also practiced sacrifice, probably human sacrifice too. But let me mention briefly something else odd. There are many seemingly unexplainable similarities between Shang culture and the Olmec flourishing in Mexico at the same time, after about 1200 BC. And most scholars don't think that there could have been contact, and they assume the similarities have to do with American origins in Asia thousands of years before. But it's weird. You look at the pottery, they're nearly the same. They both use jade in similar ways. And if you look at Olmec features on the figurines, they really look Chinese. It's bizarre. But let's get to the next dynasty, the Zhou, another set of invaders that arrived from the west around 1000 BC, and maybe even of Turkic origin. They took over all of the former kingdom. They extended it. They extended the system of vassalage, and that was strengthened. And what this meant is that the feudal aristocracy had virtual control in their own region and just owed allegiance and taxes and men for building projects or maybe war for the king. And increasingly, the Zhou centralized their kingdom, claiming that the king was a kind of semi-divine being with the mandate of heaven, which gives you a kind of strength, but can also lead you to be blamed should something go wrong. You know, in other words, a ruler can lose this mandate of heaven. The Zhou also apparently introduced the domesticated soybean to China, or at least popularized it. And more importantly, cast iron. Now, why is that important? It can be made into very strong farm tools, into sharp weapons, into cooking vessels. A slow, gradual development, but it means much more land can be cultivated and you can grow more people as a result. Think of it that way. The most important thing about this dynasty is the earliest development of a professional bureaucracy of scholars running this increasingly centralized government. After about 700 BC, these Shi, that's what they're called, became members of the crucial transmitters of culture from the top all the way down. They're the people who kept records, issued proclamations, they served as advisors, and they are the ones who organized these huge irrigation projects. They extended rice cultivation, and naturally the population grows immensely. And also there are new implements, things like a four-pronged hoe. So all of this naturally leads to more expansion also. There are more millets. That's in fact still the primary staple. Rice, wheat, barley is introduced. They grew kudzu for fiber and ate its edible shoots and roots, various kinds of cabbages, gourds, melons, lotus, daylilies, all sorts of green leafy vegetables, various species of apricots and peaches, a kind of plum, and even the Chinese quince. And these, in fact, are cultivated as domestic crops. Okay? From about 500 BC or so, Chinese civilization really blossoms under the Zhou, actually another Eastern Zhou dynasty after a period of turmoil, but this is regarded as the classical age of ancient Chinese culture. There's poetry and scholarship flourishes, science and technology and detailed understanding of the stars. And probably more important than anything, there's one thinker in particular who's central to Chinese thought. This is in the West called Confucius or Kung Fu Zhe. Zhe means master, who lived from 551 to 479. Briefly, Confucius thought that proper behavior, understanding where you are in the social hierarchy, and always obeying your superiors, whether it means parents or political rulers or older brother, that will not only foster social harmony, but reflects and influences cosmic harmony. In other words, if the family or state are in discord, so are the heavens. So obedience, ritually prescribed ways of addressing your superiors, or in fact, dealing with your inferiors, that will prevent misunderstanding and discord. And so everyone has to know exactly who is superior or inferior to them. And Confucian thought actually becomes the ruling principle of Chinese politics, and the bureaucrats, the Shi, become the crucial functionaries of the state. And as you can imagine, the individual, things like individual desires, rights, whatever, you know, those things, are subordinated to the good of the whole and to maintaining harmony. That is, you have to respect and obey your superiors, even if they're wrong. Okay? So this is not like a caste system. This has to do with individuals and how they deal with others. And it's based on filial piety and obedience within a family. And it's sort of like a building block, if you want to think of it, of the greater political family. Now, why is this significant for food history? It means that ritualization of daily life, including eating, becomes the rule. And there are explicit manners. Okay? Let's think of what manners mean. They are a way to reduce the threat of violence, okay? So there's never any confusion about how you were to behave. And it's not coincidental that this is the period when chopsticks become used widely. Why? Well, think about what it means to have a sharp knife at the table. It's potentially threatening, right? You might pull it on someone in a moment of anger. And here, so here, everything is cut up into bite-sized pieces behind the scenes. And you can dispense with that barbarity of cutting up, you know, hunks of flesh or disgusting some of them with your dirty fingers dipped into a common bowl. So here, you are physically distanced from the animal act of eating with these two elegant wooden sticks. And the Chinese adapt a form of refined tableware, in fact, before any other civilization. I mean, spoons, those are pretty much around everywhere in the ancient world. But Europeans, for example, use a knife and their fingers well into the 17th century. American colonists, even later than that. But the Chinese are using chopsticks hundreds of years BC. There's also one other thinker of this period. Let me mention him also. This is Lao Tzu from the 6th century BC, means Master Lao. He's the father of Taoism. And the major principle governing Taoist thought is that an individual should live in harmony with nature, not try and do things unsuited to your nature or beyond your limitations. And it's really a matter of accepting who you are and what you're good at, and basically not trying to be something that you're not. So this is basically a philosophy of inaction, right? It's not like Confucianism. It's a matter of personal integrity and simplicity, or being what they call the uncarved block, being selfless and patient. And the importance of these ideas for food history is the emphasis on simplicity and closeness to nature. Taoist sages, in fact, promote a very simple lifestyle that'll be held as an ideal in Chinese culture and will stand in stark opposition to luxuriant, ritualized, artificial court culture. And another thing just worthy of mentioning is that they promote longevity regimes and medicines that are become central into the Chinese pharmacopoeia. But the easiest way to remember these three ancient teachings, and it's actually a food story, is there's a painting which is called The Vinegar Tasters. And it shows these three scholars standing around this bowl of vinegar. And the vinegar represents life. And the Confucian tastes it, and he finds it sour. And that's a typical scholar, you know, sort of worrying about everything in its neat little box, making things just the way they're supposed to be, and in fact, getting upset when every little thing doesn't go his way or it's not done according to strict protocol, right? He's always sour about being offended in some way, the Confucian. And then there's the Buddhist. He tastes it, and he finds it bitter. And everything is pain and suffering, and he tries hard not to taste it. And lastly, the Taoist tastes it, and he's smiling as he puts the thing up to his mouth. And he accepts vinegar for what it is, and he's enjoying it, even though it really is sour. But it's going with nature rather than always fighting against it. And you probably met people like that, too. You know, they're sort of congenitally happy, even in the worst of situations. Well, that's the Taoist. So something else that develops in this period is the yin-yang system recorded in the I Ching that forms the basis of Chinese medicine and dietary ideas. I'll come to that in just a bit. But the next dynasty, the Qin, from whom we get the word China, very brief but really decisive for history because the use of cavalry, the introduction of the crossbow, bringing freed peasants into the army. I mean, this is really the first true Chinese empire. It replaces local warlords with bureaucrats, which we'll see is a crucial feature of Chinese cuisine. And it lasted only from 221 to 207 BC, but it introduced, in fact, a form of government that lasted all the way into the 20th century. So the most important ruler of this period is Shi Huang Ti. And during this period, the scattered old defensive walls were linked up to the original Great Wall, most of which, I mean, it's later rebuilt and extended in other dynasties. And I think much of what we would see today is Ming Dynasty, but it's put in place here to start with. The huge Qin Palace complex was built with 700,000 workers forced into labor. They introduced standard weights and measures, coinage, roads and canals built. So we're talking infrastructure here, right? And all of this tends to unify China into one culinary culture, despite the fact that there are still massive regional differences. You might also know that there was a tomb uncovered in 1974 that contained this whole army of terracotta warriors, right? These life-size, detailed clay soldiers. That's from this period. The Qin Dynasty collapsed just a few years after the death of the emperor, but the Han Dynasty, that's about 202 BC, to 220 AD, and there's one little interruption in there, but that adopted many of the principles of this earlier dynasty and in fact extended the empire and ushered in a period of long-lasting peace, flourishing about the same time as ancient Rome, okay? And Han is actually the name used to designate the ethnic Chinese today, okay? This is the period when Confucian doctrine became state policy. There was an imperial university to train scholar bureaucrats with rigorous exams. And in fact, any promising scholar could take them. You know, it has nothing to do with birth. And here is that social mobility factor, right? Which is essential for the evolution of culinary fashions. In practice, it's usually wealthy, educated people who send their children to be educated, but it still meant that they could gain power and prestige, and there was a kind of access to court life also. Cities and trade extended in this period. In fact, this is when there's a direct link all the way across to Rome. Exploration takes place across the Indian Ocean, and the Silk Road flourishes in this period. And in fact, if we think about it, this is how spices get to Hellenistic Greece and eventually to Rome. But think about it this way. A census of 2 AD put the population at 60 million people. The Han capital was at Shan. Chang'an was the original name back then. But it was a city laid out in a gridwork containing a huge walled palace of 100,000 people, and then another 150,000 beyond that, as well as a kind of internal city where the emperor lived, a forbidden city with only the imperial family, the servants, the advisors, the guards, and increasingly their eunuchs also. I guess they were considered trustworthy to guard the imperial wives and concubines. But this was in turn surrounded by an imperial city of administrators. And China on the whole was probably the most urbanized civilization on earth at this time. And what that meant is an extraordinary level of organization was required just to feed these cities. The state adopted a rigorous agricultural policy. And in fact, some people have called this the world's first green revolution, meaning that intense agriculture increased yields. And here's how they did it. It makes a lot of sense if you think about it. They had a very low tax on land. They allowed a class of small independent farmers to flourish. And the idea is that, you know, if you have your own plot of land, you will take better care of it. You'll improve it for profit. You'll think about the market and you'll sell to people exactly what they want, right? Agricultural extension projects, things like textbooks, encyclopedias. Scholars were sent out to instruct farmers or even to collect new plant species. For example, the grape and alfalfa. Sesame probably came in during this period, as did cinnamon from India. So Sichuan pepper is introduced, and new fruits like longan and lychee and sugarcane and oranges from India. Spinach and carrots supposedly also come from the West, but they may have come later also, some people argue. But number four, okay, public works, things like irrigation systems, state-operated granaries. Number five, public relief. Number six, state-sponsored sponsorship of medical research. And we're talking here about research into the properties of plants and foodstuffs. And a lot of it is just pure public scholarship. Some of it is, sent right into the public to use. But let me briefly describe one classic agricultural work in the first century BC, written by Sheng Qie. And it's describes multiple cropping, like wheat in winter and millet in summer. It describes how to treat your seeds to keep them for the next year so they don't get rotten or eaten by pests, how to irrigate rice fields, how to recirculate water so it's warmer in the spring and cooler in the summer. It has a whole section on how to use mulch to keep in moisture throughout the winter. Fascinating book. It also describes how to cultivate in pits, so you trap moisture. It's kind of like a sunken bed with stakes to support vegetables like gourds and things like that. Ridge cultivation along hills so that things drain well. And all sorts of detailed information about use of fertilizers, when to water, when to plant, I mean, which soils are best for what kind of crops, how to save plants that contain nitrogen to act as green manure, and maybe most important, how to use these iron implements. So the technological advances of this period are staggering. I don't even have to mention things like gunpowder, compasses, water mills, mining, silk manufacture. There's also the early instances of porcelain. That's porcelain's a combination of white kaolin and feldspar, and you fire it really high, and it's not only strong, but it's translucent and beautifully white. So in terms of material culture, the Chinese have the most advanced arts of the ancient world, and that includes the art of cookery. New food technology is first introduced here. Fermenting soy products, what's called zhang, is an ancestor of miso and of soy sauce. And actually, fermentation, interestingly, makes the soybean a lot more nutritious as well. You can't really live on soybeans as a protein source unless you ferment them. New pickling techniques are introduced. Vegetables, salt-cured meats like lap chung, dried meats. Noodle technology also is introduced. And that's dependent on being able to finely grind and bolt the wheat. And in fact, just a couple of years ago, 2005, I think, the oldest noodles on earth were discovered at La Jia. They are 4,000 years old. They're made of millet, but still, they're noodles. Improved brewing techniques. Millet is still the preferred grain for making it. Rice, some reason, is considered inferior. And perhaps considered the most important Han innovation is this hammered iron bowl placed over an intensely hot stoked fire so it can be used to cook foods in seconds. We're, of course, talking about a wok, right? And stir frying. And interestingly, the ones, they don't survive any woks from this period because they're iron, they rust, they disappear. But they're clay models that people were buried with, and those survive, and they look just like modern woks, you know, the curve with the two little handles on the side. There's also emphasis in the texts that mentions cooking by cutting meat into very thin, even slices. And so food preparation is brought to a very high art. And I think use of this technique implies that A, they're making oil on a large scale, probably sesame first, and they're cooking because of lack of fuel, really, in a wok very, very quickly as a stir fry, as we would think of today. Lastly, let's talk about Chinese medicine. It reaches its high point, and there actually are state-salaried physicians, colleges and examination boards, and even the first regulated professional medical system in the world. The theories formulated in this period are still echoed today, making this the oldest living medical system on Earth. Contemporary with Galen, incidentally, but that one, of course, died out centuries ago. The Yellow Emperor's classic of internal medicine, supposedly written by this sort of semi-mythic figure, one of the celestial emperors of ancient times, named Huang Ti, but actually composed in the Han Dynasty. So let me introduce just a few concepts about health and diet. The first is qi, and that's translated as energy, life force, spirit. It what keeps you alive and fights off bad outside influences, and it also flows through the whole universe. So the individual microcosm is kind of linked to the macrocosm. Health occurs when the two forces are in harmony. You get prosperity, peace in the state, good crops, and that's living according to the mandate of heaven for the emperor, knowing your position in society for the average person. And it's not just a matter of politics here. It's a matter of health. If you disobey, you generate bad qi and you get sick. Okay? And the central governing principle is the opposition of two basic universal forces, the yin and the yang. The yin is the female, dark, cold, soft, empty, night. The yang is the male. Light, warm, firm, full, and day. Universal harmony and physical health depends on a balance of these two forces. And there are not only exactly, they're not really elements, but let's call them phases or processes of transformation in nature. And there are five of them: earth, fire, wood, metal, and water. And what I mean by a process is, for example, in a cycle of generation, water makes trees grow, wood burned creates fire, fire creates ash, like the earth. Earth is the source of metals, and metals flow like water when heated. Or if you go the other way, a cycle of destruction. Water puts out fire. Fire melts metal. Metal axe cuts wood. Wooden plow tills the earth. A dam of earth stops water. And it's sort of a, you know, poetic explanation of nature. But realize that they're not building blocks of nature. They are the processes of change in nature. And all physiological functions can be described in terms of these transformations, like breaking down and processing food. A specific food or drugs aid a particular process. They build good qi, or they promote its flow through the body. And in fact, that's what acupuncture is for, to help qi flow. And just as in the other systems I've mentioned, this is holistic medicine. It takes account of exercise, air quality, sleep patterns, sexual activity, and of course, diet. Keeping the yin and yang forces in balance, keeping the qi flowing and the physiological transformations in good order. It has an extremely complex pharmacopoeia that goes with it. Shen Nung's herbal discusses 365 drugs based on plants, animals, and minerals. And that's just one example. I mean, there survive, though rarely translated, a variety of works on medicine, agriculture, the philosophy of food, food laws, even what we would call gastronomy, the art of fine dining. The accomplishments of the Han Dynasty were also built upon in successive dynasties, the Song, the Tang in the Middle Ages, and which we'll cover in later in the course. But together, these periods laid the foundations for what would become arguably the most complex, sophisticated, and varied culinary tradition on Earth.